going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive. Up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
That's right, it is the Going Deep podcast, and I am Donovan Bennett, and this is the month of November, which means that, well, we give away a couple football trophies in our country, but also we spend time thinking about things that are really important. And November is also Lung Cancer Awareness Month. It's a disease that impacts thousands of Canadians, but one that doesn't have to impact them as seriously if it is detected early. Canada actually has one of the highest rates of lung cancer cases in the world. It's staggering 50% are diagnosed at stage 4, and at which point survival is sadly extremely low. Which brings me to the question of how can we flip the script on those stats, be a bit more proactive to keep us healthier and safer from the punishing disease that is lung cancer. Well, a Canadian that has been committed to helping us do that is one of our great Canadian athletes. It's our hockey icon, Haley Wickenheiser, who certainly has lended her voice to many different causes, whether it was conquering COVID-19 or the importance for women and girls to have a safe, equitable place in sports, specifically in hockey. And certainly, as she has great expertise in the medical field, this is another issue that is close to her heart as a doctor, which is why Haley's partnered with Merck Canada to challenge Canadians to essentially be the MVP of their own health, specifically, and get an early lead on the disease that is impacting Canadians increasingly right now. So let's go deep on all things going on in her life and why Haley Wickenheiser decided to add this campaign to what is already a very full plate. One of the greatest Canadians to ever lace them up, Haley Wickenheiser on Going Deep.
So Haley, thanks for joining us on the podcast once again. And once again, you are using your platform, using your time and energy to speak to Canadians about a really important cause. But there are so many, specifically around our mental and physical health, that deserve attention. What about Laces Up for Lung Cancer spoke to you about something you wanted to speak about?
Yeah, well, you know, just being able to team up with Merck here to challenge all Canadians to change the odds. It was surprising to me, even as a doctor, to learn that, you know, Canada is one of the highest rates of lung cancer cases and deaths in the world. And by the time people are diagnosed, 50% of Canadians are already at stage 4, which is a really tough survival point. So, you know, there's a bit of a personal connection for me too. I lost my grandfather lung cancer. He was a lifelong smoker. And in medical school, I spent a couple rotations inside surgery. One of those was with the lung cancer team. So I got a chance to see, you know, surgeries, resections, things like that. And, you know, it's something that if you get early enough at stage 1, the chance of survival is over 70% after 3 years. But if it goes too far, it's a really devastating disease, as so many cancers are. But so it's a really good campaign, Be the MVP campaign that Merck's embarked on here. This is the third year in a row. And just for patients and caregivers to say, hey, something's not right, go see your doctor, get checked out. There's lots of different programs and screenings that are there for Canadians.
I love that you mentioned changing the odds, because when we look at things from a sports context, whether it's, you know, building teams, we're trying to put ourselves in an optimal position to win. And hopefully, you know, that happens. I remember a summer job that I had as a university student. I was OR attendant. And so I'd bring in patients and bring them to floors and whatnot. And it struck me that no matter what was going on with the patient, one of the first questions was, are you a smoker? What's your health? Because there were indicators in terms of what that meant based off of their outcomes. What can Canadians do to put the odds in a favorable position in terms of lung cancer?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you hit the biggest risk factor being smoking. So we know that the research says that the more times that your family doctor asks you about your smoking and your interest to quit, the more likely that people are to actually stop smoking. It's kind of interesting research. But definitely, if you stop smoking, you can actually, over time, reverse some of that damage to your lung and give yourself much better odds. There's also things that maybe people aren't realizing, exposure to chemicals, things like radon. There's family history that plays a part of this, some of the genetics. I think there's also just some pure bad luck that people come into. Secondhand smoke is another one. So there's lots of things that we can do in our environment. I think that's one thing that's interesting with lung cancer is there's a bit of controllable things that we can embark on. And then, of course, just if you are concerned yourself or you have a loved one, just even speaking to the family doctor in Ontario, there's a program that if you're high risk between the ages of 55 and 74, you can be screened for 3 years with a low-dose CT. So those are some of the things that are in place to try to catch these cancers early. And then we know if we get them early, the chance of death is much lower.
Looking at a program like Hockey Fights Cancer and the platform that sport can have over the last years, I was struck about how important the awareness piece was. It would seem to be simple, but people really didn't understand until they digged in and found some of the data that you just explained. How are we trending? Are things getting better? Are they getting worse? How are we doing in terms of this issue in Canada, but also globally?
Yeah, I mean, I think, we're not doing as great as we could be. Canada has, like I said, one of the highest rates of lung cancer cases in the world. And I think some of the stats I have is like 2022 in Canada, it was estimated that approximately 1 in 4 cancer deaths would be from lung cancer, which is it's kind of shocking, really. And then, 1 in 15 Canadians in 2022, the data showed that 1 in 15 Canadians were expected to be diagnosed with lung cancer in their lifetime. So that's those are pretty daunting odds, really. 30,000 new diagnoses, 20,000 deaths in 2022 alone for lung and bronchus cancer. So some of those statistics, I think if we can raise the awareness, get people to really cue in on their health early, we can drop those rates probably pretty quickly. And one of the challenges is also coming out of the pandemic. Something that I see inside medicine is people are often coming in waiting. They haven't been able to get a family doctor. They can't see their family doctor. And now people seem to be much sicker when they come to access care, whether it's the family medicine clinic or in the hospital at the emergency department. So just for people to know, hey, there are resources out there. Don't sit in silence or suffer in silence. If you are, experiencing some of the symptoms, then you need to reach out.
In the height of the COVID-19 pandemic, we talked about the knock-on effect that would have on our healthcare in general and what OR wait times were like, what emergency rooms were like. Given, some of the numbers that you've just talked about, and given that, certainly issues like COVID are not over and can continue to rise, how are we doing now in terms of our capacity in our healthcare system in Canada?
I think we're bursting at the seams. Donna, I'm pretty new. I'm the rookie in the healthcare system. But I've been inside the healthcare system now for 5 years and just, practicing as a staff now. But from what I see, I work emergency medicine. And from what I see, there's never beds available. There's always wait times. You're never just standing around not having a patient to see. It just is a continual flow of never-ending stress on the system. There's a lot of burnout in our system. So there has to be ways forward to alleviate that and to make our system more efficient. There's a tremendous amount inside of family medicine, which is where I trained, tremendous amount of administrative burden on physicians to chart and record and I think it's one of the biggest turnoffs of why we don't have a big crop of new physicians wanting to be family doctors. So there's lots of complex issues within our system, but I wouldn't say that it's going great. But I will say that as a Canadian, I feel very comfortable to say that if you are sick or not feeling well, if you go to care, you're going to get pretty good care across this country. So that makes me proud to work inside of the system.
Well, there's a balance there, and there's always a debate between, you know, private and public. Is there an optimal way to balance efficiency, but also balance the standard of care that you get as a Canadian, no matter where you live or what your circumstances are?
Yeah, I think there has to be at least an openness to look at some sort of a private public system. My biggest concern would be that every Canadian deserves the right to the best quality of care, regardless of where you are, what your life circumstances are, how much money you have. And so I would never want to see a drain on public resources in favor of private. That would be my concern. And that's why I think we have something very special in this country where we don't have people without health insurance or care. You know, if you're sick, you're going to get care and you're not going to have a massive bill most times at the end of it. So, but there has to be a new look moving forward. I think Canadian innovation and technology, Canadian made solutions when it comes to like EMR programs like this one, be the MVP, where you get early detection, because a part of our system is just spent so much time on reaction versus prevention. And so this program is really great because it's saying, hey, we're encouraging you, the patient, the person to go out and take care of your own health and be proactive. So I think there's a lot of things proactively we can do, like be the MVP, where we can catch some of these things early and then not burden the system later on.
You mentioned reaction rather than prevention and being, you know, proactive. I look at you in your role on the hockey side as it's ever evolving, and obviously there's somewhat new management, and you're building development systems and pathways for players to play. As your role on the hockey side continues to evolve, but also as your role in healthcare continues to build and evolve, how has it been managing your time, your energy, your personal efficiencies?
Well, I feel like I have a bit of my life back, seeing as I finished residency. And when you're in residency in medicine, your life is not your own. You're following a schedule that's laid out for you, and you really don't have any flexibility. But now that I'm a staff physician and I'm able to set up my own schedule, create my own time, it's actually been great. I can manage both quite seamlessly. And, you know, if there's a day we don't have a game or something to do, I'm often in the emergency department working. So I like the balance of both, because one reminds me how much I love the other. So whether, you know, I'm in the emergency, I'm seeing people having the worst day of their life, and you know, reminds me of what's important. And then I step inside the hockey rink and realize that sport brings so much joy and hope to people in such a dark time. So I think that I got two great, great gigs here. I'm able to manage both, and I get to do things like, you know, here working with Merck and be the MVP, which is something that I'm really a big believer in as well.
Sport brings hope, it also brings awareness. We've seen that certainly. This campaign is an example. And as I mentioned before, Hockey Fights Cancer is an example. There has been a very heated debate in terms of what that awareness looks like within a league like the NHL and what should or shouldn't be done visibly. Can you speak tangibly on what you've experienced in terms of the ability to use sport, use the power of institutions like hockey in our country to bring awareness and visibility to causes that maybe are not necessarily as easy to talk about?
Well, for sure. I mean, athletes are role models. And in Canada, there's nothing more holier than hockey players, the NHL. I mean, everybody loves the Olympics. We love to watch the sport every 4 years, but no other sport in this country gets coverage like hockey does and like the NHL does. So for you know, to be able to have a platform to be a force for good, that's how I saw it as an athlete, is if there was something I believe strongly in and I felt like, you know, similar to the oath you take in medicine, which is do no harm. It's kind of the the oath that I think you should operate as. Do no harm, help as many people as you can, and use your platform for good. So I think a lot of athletes do that. Some are more comfortable than others, and really it should, you know, be that individual choice that, you know, people have causes that are near and dear to their heart. This one, you know, lung cancer, I've seen lung cancer. I've seen stage 4 lung cancer, what a lung looks like in a living body. I've seen my grandfather, you know, watched him die of lung cancer. So these are things that are, you know, they're easy to talk about because it's personal. So I think when athletes stick to things that they know and they're passionate about, it really rings true to people, and you connect with people that way. And people look to sport, I think, for hope and for a bit of an escape from sometimes how, you know, sad that our regular world can be, especially now. So it's really important. It's meaningful. And I think you have a chance to change lives.
Yeah, there was a debate on whether or not NHL players were going to be able to use something like Pride Tape. There was no debate that when the PWHL came around that those players were going to be able to be vocal, because quite frankly, the existence of the league was them being activists for their rights and their causes. Now that you've seen what it's taken to get to the league, on board, to see the draft happen, to see, obviously, you know, puck drop not too long from now, I wonder what your thoughts are for someone who had to go abroad, had to play in, you know, different scenarios and leagues to see, you know, what is out there for female hockey players now.
Well, I think it's great. I mean, it's probably 5-10 years later than it should have happened, but like better late than never, I guess. And it seems like the money backing this league is real and legitimate, and it, you know, they will have a chance to survive for many years. So I think, you know, I'm really happy that like any little girl in this country can grow up and say, you know, I said I wanted to play for the Edmonton Oilers and be a Stanley Cup champion. And now they can grow up and say, I want to play for, you know, PWHL Toronto team, and I want to make money being a professional women's hockey player. And also the other thing is that it's really going to help the women's game around the world. The NHL was great for international hockey because the best players in the world came to play in one league, Borya Salming and players like this. And we need the best players in other countries to be in this league and exposed so that they take home and make their other countries great, so that international hockey becomes stronger, more competitive and sustainable at the Olympic level. So I think there's a lot of great things about it. I hope that they get off to a good start, and look forward to watching the progress.
And lastly, you mentioned better late than never, you know, in terms of one of your focuses, obviously, you know, helping the Toronto Maple Leafs and their fans. If the Leafs were to win the Cup this year, no one will remember all the heartbreak from now since 1967. You know, all past sins will be forgotten. But there is almost an atmosphere of, you've been really good, you've had great regular seasons, wake me up in the spring and let me know how you do then, from the fan base. I just wonder, in terms of mentality, with such high expectations within the organization, how it is managing the day-to-day process, knowing ultimately you're going to be judged on what happens so far from now.
Well, I think one of the greatest things about being here in Toronto is that it's like playing for Canada in the Olympics. There's no other color of medal other than a gold one that people really accept when you play hockey, when you play on the women's team, you go to the Olympic Games. And whether it's like overtly said or not, that's just the way it is. And that's kind of how I felt as a player my entire career. And I feel the same here in Toronto with the pursuit of trying to win a Stanley Cup, is that the people here are so passionate. They love hockey so much. The team has not won a Stanley Cup since 67, that there's this desire to see that again, of course. So it's always better, you know, I always say that it's always better to be somewhere where people care than where they don't care at all. And but the thing with that is that you can't focus on that every day. You have to just focus on literally the day, the moment, the shift, the game, and you hope that you stack a lot of great shifts, great games, and good days over and over and over again, and you develop the habits that a winning team has to be able to, in the moment of truth, bring it and perform. And, you know, we have a really good team here. It it's been disappointing. Like, it's very obvious to everyone in the playoffs the last couple of seasons. And so it's about just pushing that bit more, demanding that of each other to push it through the top. But I think by hyper-focusing on that, you almost push it away. So you have to be really good with staying in the moment. And it sounds cliched, but there really is no other way.
Yeah, no question. You certainly had a great working relationship with Kyle, and now that you're working with, you know, Brad, does that change the way you work at all? Do you provide, you know, different things to the group based off of a different style, need, personality?
No, you know what? My role and my job has really not changed at all with Brad coming in. I have just sort of been doing the same thing that I did when Kyle was here. Brad's been really supportive of the systems we have in place, the way we approach development, how we work with the players. He's been happy, you know, about our process. So we're just carrying forward. It's going to take Brad a little bit of time to figure out the machine that is the Toronto Maple Leafs. It's a much bigger operation than the Calgary Flames. So, but it's been a good adjustment. He's a really good person, you know, very thoughtful, considerate guy. And I think he cares a lot about the players and making sure that everybody's comfortable to have success.
Love to hear that you remain empowered in your role. Love to hear you empowering Canadians to take action on their own health. And love to hear you talk about, you know, importance of role models for young Canadians. Because you are one, both if people want to be leaders as a player in management, or if they want to be a leader in healthcare, which you are. So thank you so much for doing all that you do for us. And thank you for sharing.
Okay, thanks for having me, Donovan. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much to Haley. And if you want more information and resources about everything that she described, you can go to Merck Canada, MERCK.ca, or BeTheMVP.ca, so that you or your loved one can be the MVP versus lung cancer. Again, no matter the topic, Haley Wickenheiser has stood up for our country and has been the MVP in many different facets and roles. Certainly, she's doing that every day as a physician, and certainly she's doing that every day as an advocate for lung cancer awareness. And she gives me a bit of hope on how the Toronto Maple Leafs might fare in the postseason this year. Decorated Olympian is Haley Wickenheiser, really a trailblazer. Same is true for our next guest. We're going to talk to Maggie McNeil, who had an outstanding Pan Am Games for Canada, after the break.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson has a show.
And I'm so happy that you're listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had a show. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Grandma and Granddad. And yes, we've got another decorated Olympian on the program today. That person is the magnificent Maggie McNeil, who is dominating the pool right now as a swimmer for Canada. She has just won 5 gold medals for Canada in Santiago 2023, which sets the record for the most gold medals by a Canadian at one edition of the Pan Am Games. And it wasn't just the 5 golds. She won 7 medals total. This just ends what has been a banner season for her in the pool. But outside the pool, she's really been busy studying as a master's student. So how does Maggie find time to master it all? We learn now on Going Deep. So Maggie, an unprecedented performance at the Pan Ams this year. You pulled a LeBron James, not one, not two, not three, not four, 5 gold medals, becoming the only Canadian athlete to win 5 gold medals at a single Pan Am Games. As you went through the competition, stacking W's, what was that like for you?
I mean, it's definitely always a fun experience to swim well, and obviously our team as a whole did amazing, and to be a part of that, I think it was like the second highest or highest gold medal count we've ever had outside of a hosted Pan Am game, so that's always an exciting thing for us. But honestly, I went in kind of with almost no expectation for myself, other than like wanting to win the 100 fly to kind of secure that title. I was kind of just like, oh, we'll see how the year's going. Like, I've been training really well, and I just competed in Athens at a World Cup the weekend before, so it was just kind of working on improving those small little details, whether that was like starts, kick counts, the usual, and just improving like a little bit from weekend to weekend. But I definitely didn't expect to come away with 7 medals and to have that great of a game.
So you've won a lot of medals on the world stage before, so I don't think people were necessarily surprised that you won a lot of medals at Pan Ams, but the times are what jumped out to me. Did you surprise even your own self about how fast you were swimming, given how late it is in the season?
For sure. And I mean, after Worlds this summer, Pan Ams fell at a weird time this year in October. So I took about 2.5 weeks off this summer. So it was really about just trying to get back in shape and get back into it. So that's why I probably didn't have that many expectations on myself. But I was really pleased with particularly my freestyles. My fly, I wish it was a little bit faster, honestly, but I've never been that fast this early on. So yes, I'll take that as well. But to go a best time in the 100 free was really exciting for me. And I've never really done it internationally before. So that was a good, I guess, practice run for hopefully realizing Paris.
So after you win Olympic medals, you had Ryan Reynolds hollering at you on social. What was the feedback and support like from notable people after the Pan Ams?
I wouldn't say there's anything really that stuck out, but just seeing all the love from the Chilean fans was amazing. They were such a great crowd and great group, and it really brought the energy up in the pool, and that's something you can't really replicate, and I think that definitely helped to bring out the performances, because I did swim a lot, and by the end of the meet, I was feeling pretty beaten down, but just to always have the energy in the pool made it feel like not as hard.
Well, they were familiar with you because you were on billboards all over the place. In January, the organizers of the Pan Ams brought you to Chile and introduced you as one of the ambassadors of the event. How did that come together, and what was that honor like?
Oh, it was such a special thing, and I think that's also probably what enhanced my experience at my first Pan Am Games. And they reached out to me, I want to say, a year ago this time. And they're like, oh, we've selected a bunch of athletes from a variety of different sports in a variety of different countries, and we'd like you to be the swim one, and for Canada, obviously. And I was really excited about it. It's something I hadn't done before, so I was like, yeah, definitely. And then they decided later on that they wanted to shoot on location. I don't think it was originally supposed to be in Santiago, but it was great getting to experience like the flight and kind of get a little bit more familiar with the country and the food and things like that. Because that's one of the hard things about a games environment is that there's so many uncontrollables that could really make your performance make or break it, I guess. So just having that kind of experience in my back pocket was definitely helpful when we got to the games. But it turned out everything, the promo, just the exposure, the experience just turned out way better than I could have imagined it would.
Turned out well for your team, as you mentioned, and one of your teammates specifically. Marie-Sophie Harvey also had an outstanding performance. What was that like to see her shine on the big stage?
Oh, it was so special. And we did most of the relays together. So that was always fun. And she just started swimming the 100 free more seriously at the end of last season. So for her to be putting up those times and anchoring all of our relays so well was definitely inspiring. But we've been racing each other since we were like 12. So it's been over a decade. And it's hard to stay at a level like this for that long. And she's been around a little bit longer than I have on the international scene. So we definitely got a lot closer as well during the meet. And she's so fun and such a fun person to be around.
People don't realize that big meets like this, you were watching the times come in, cheering for multiple teammates, your national teammates, but also for someone like you, your training teammates and your college teammates. LSU in general had a great game, specifically in the pool. I don't know what's going on down south in the bayou. What was it like to see your fellow Tigers do so well?
Yeah, definitely inspiring for sure. I mean, there weren't too many of us there, but it was great for me to catch up with some of my old Michigan teammates as well. Katie DeLoop in particular from the U.S., who I hadn't seen in it's been a couple of years since I've seen her. So it was really great to race her and brought back some good memories.
You mentioned the timing of this event, and because of it, not just maybe in the pool, but certainly in other disciplines, a bunch of athletes said, it's so late in the season, I'm not sure if I want to be there. You've taken a break from swimming in the past. Why now are you feeling, you know, good physically, mentally enough, you know, to compete? And what has that break been able to do for you?
Yeah, like it wasn't, I wouldn't say a huge break. But yeah, so I didn't end up swimming individually at the World Championships last, what was it, June of 2022. Because we've had so many competitions from COVID, they've kind of been added in as opposed to kind of getting back on the normal schedule that we would normally see. So usually Worlds is every odd year. But since Tokyo, in our like condensed quad, I guess 3 years, we've had three or four long course worlds, two short course world championships, a Pan Am Games and a Commonwealth Games. So it's been a lot of racing internationally. So that's definitely one of the reasons I took a step back last summer. But I knew I always wanted to do a Pan Am Games, and we're in the lead up to Paris now. And I mean, I haven't really thought too much about it until now, because I was really focused on Pan Am Games and kind of taking it one step at a time. So it was Worlds this summer, then Pan Am. So now I'm starting to look more toward Paris. So it was pretty much a training meet for me to kind of practice my strategies and play with little things, and obviously race freestyle internationally, which I haven't done before. So it was good in that sense, and was able to switch it up and practice relays with even mixed relays with the guys, and just a different team in general, and where I could act more as a veteran. So it was definitely a learning experience and a good practice run for Paris all around.
You mentioned that lead up to Paris. Tokyo obviously was great, but you were robbed of the true Olympic experience because of COVID. What are you looking forward to in relation to the Olympic experience in Paris?
Yeah, I mean, I was lucky in the fact that it was my first game, so I wasn't really aware of what we were missing out on, but obviously would love to be able to check out some other sports and, of course, go to closings. We had to leave the village within, I think it was 48 hours in Tokyo, which sucks because we couldn't stay for closing. And as swimming starts the very first day of competition, we never get to participate in the opening ceremony. So that was also something really special that I got to do for Pan Ams as an ambassador, be able to go and do that. So that was really exciting as my first kind of opening slash closing experience. But I'm excited to do that. And then obviously, yeah, go check out some other events and just meet people and be able to chat with other people in the village. I mean, we were very regimented and kind of wanted to stay either within our bubble as Team Canada, but even more so as Swimming Canada.
As you taper towards Paris, you obviously want to stay in the moment and dominate each day, but those days continue to go down and down and down. Is there someone in your life, in your team, that is reminding you of how far Paris is away?
I wouldn't say so. Obviously, it's coming up a lot faster, and we're almost in the new year. So I think once January hits, I think it'll feel a lot faster. But yeah, no, not so much. I haven't really thought, oh, I have so many days left or whatever.
It's probably because you're incredibly busy. You know, you're still a student athlete. And whether it's, you know, master's, postgraduate degree in sport administration, you know, down the road, you want to be a lawyer and get a law degree. How do you manage all that it takes to be a high level student with being a elite level athlete?
It's definitely hard. And obviously, like, I've grown up doing it, so it's kind of second nature to me. But this semester in particular, I found particularly busy. I mean, I'm in my master's degree. I'm not really in class as much as I was in undergrad, so that's always a nice thing, but it's having the time management skills to be organized when I'm not in class and like when I'm doing with my days. Like one of my classes, I'm reading 7 articles and writing a 5-page paper every week. So I only have 2 more of those left. So definitely counting down the end of the semester and excited to have a little break from school and be able to focus on swimming before I start my last semester next year.
That's why you're not counting down to Paris. You're counting down the end of the semester so you can get all that reading done. Talk to me about the time management. What does your day-to-day routine look like between being in the pool and hitting the books?
Yeah, for sure. And I am a pro now, so I'm not on the college team anymore, which has been a different challenge for me, having more control over my like meet schedule and obviously what meets I want to go to. And I was gone from school for 3 weeks in October. So about a lot of being proactive with my professors, I had told them back in June that I'd be gone and they were totally fine with it. And at this level, I was really happy that they were willing to work with me to make sure I can get all my assignments done and be as flexible as possible. So definitely that is super important. But daily, I would say I can go. I have a little bit more flexibility some mornings with the times that I go in if I go and swim with the men's team as opposed to the women's team. So usually like 6 to 8 a.m. is pretty standard training, just swimming, or there's like a swim and a lift combo, either one. And then I only have class on Monday, Wednesdays, and Thursdays in the evenings. So I have the whole day pretty much to nap, which I love doing. A couple hours will make me feel fresh and ready to go in the afternoon for practice. Or if I have an impending assignment or readings is usually what I've been doing lately. And then back to the pool in the afternoon from 2 to 4. And then a 30-minute, like a dry land circuit of spinning or like a HIIT workout. And then usually I have class after that, and then go home, have dinner, do some more homework, and then go to bed decently early. Lately, I've been kind of pushing it back a little bit. I think my body's still trying to get used to the time zone, and then repeat that.
After you bring home 5 medals, is there room for a cheat day? And if so, what is that thing that you love to indulge in to reward yourself for all of the dedication?
Oh, I feel like a lot of people know this. I'm a big ice cream person. So I wouldn't necessarily say that's a cheat day. That's kind of an everything day. At the end of my day, I'll have a little bit. My coach will always tell me, go have some ice cream. It'll do you some good. So he's always been a big proponent of that. And yeah, that's something I do pretty much every day. I wouldn't say necessarily just a cheat day thing.
Awesome. And lastly, you're consumed with getting back to the podium, representing Canada every day. And, you know, oftentimes Canadians that go in and out of their support around the big meets or around Olympic years. But what do you want Canadians to know about your story, your journey, and what your success and their support means to you?
I mean, the support means everything. And I think leading up to Tokyo, that was particularly hard with COVID and postponements and everything. But I think I had more support than I normally would have because everyone was tuning in on TV, which because that's what the world really needed at that point in time. And obviously anyone I've ever come across, I've had so many supportive messages from people that I know, people that I don't know. And I'm definitely excited for what's to come.
Well, we're excited for what you've already done in your young career and what's to come. Hopefully many Canadians are sending you tubs of ice cream to celebrate everything you've done and maybe an ice cream brand partnership on the way. But we've enjoyed watching you thus far, amazed that you can balance it all, and can't wait to see what you do next. So good luck.
Thank you so much.
So thanks to Maggie. Thanks to Haley for their time. And you know what? So listening to them over the course of this episode, I start to think about expectation when it comes to sport. We see it in this market right away. Toronto Maple Leafs being a great example where there is an aspect of wake me up in the spring. You are consistently good, consistently entertaining, but I do not care unless you hoist a trophy at the end of it. And the level of expectation, you know, whether it's an international athlete like Maggie, where it's all about medals, but it's different because you could have the race of your life and have a PB, and that's seen as a positive, even if you don't win a medal. Or you could be a gold medalist and get on the podium and get silver and bronze. There's an understanding of levels of degrees where you still get some recognition. It's not as binary as you win, you are the one team standing with a trophy, you're great. You don't win, you're terrible, until the next season starts and then it's a clean slate and you have to prove it again. Sports are supposed to be an escape and entertainment. And I feel like as fans sometimes it is an arduous process with the level of expectations we put on teams during their championship windows that we don't enjoy any of it because it's a zero-sum game and we set ourselves up for disappointment because
literally only team can win. I mean, Adam Silver is trying to do away with that with the in-season tournament. I don't know if you're going to feel great if you are a Celtics fan and you win the in-season tournament, but you don't win the Larry O.B. Like, they've got so many banners at the TD Garden. They're going to put an in-season tournament banner up. I don't know. But you must appreciate this to a certain extent as a Patriots fan. I feel like the romance of being a sports fan has lost, and it's just, show me the results now.
You know, it's funny you mentioned that, because I feel like, and maybe this is being overly cynical, but since I've started working at Sportsnet, I guess I've been working here for about 7 years, I feel like every year, my own personal fandom of teams that I grew up cheering for, whether it's, the Patriots or any of the Toronto teams, the Leafs, the Raptors, the Blue Jays, has slowly dwindled. So my own personal expectations for what a team should do or will do, I think, has changed over the years. I don't mean to make it sound like bad or anything. It's just, I think it has changed for me. But it is funny to see the... I guess even when you do have expectations, like a lot of people do for the Leafs, for example, as Haley was talking about, and maybe this is a season in which there are fewer expectations for the Raptors, for example, based on where they are as a franchise. It just, I find that whole conversation really fascinating, because I admit I've never, and this is maybe a bad thing for people who like talk on podcasts and host like evening shows and weekend shows and talk about games right as they happen. But I find it hard sometimes, Donovan, I don't know about you, but to sometimes live in the, we live and die on every win and loss that every team experiences, right? Like I remember I was talking about this with Jesse Rubinoff, our pal on Sportsnet Tonight, very recently, I guess a week or so ago. And it's just funny to think that we both have such differing views on what the Raptors should do, for example. But in the end, you know, they lose to the Celtics in the in-season tournament and get the door blown off the hinges and lose in spectacular fashion. And then they grind out a 1-point victory against the Indiana Pacers. And it kind of feels like you're looking at two different sides of the coin when it comes to what to expect out of this team. I don't know. I personally have never loved the live and die of sports fandom, which maybe has contributed to where I am today as a sports media employee. But I don't know if you feel any differently.
I feel the exact same. And, you know, if Buddy Hield takes just a half second more time to set himself and shoots what was a wide open three and the Raptors end up losing, we have an entirely different conversation about them. We talk about the lack of defensive rotation and the fact that they scored so many points, but they gave up so many points, and defensively they're not where they should be given the amount of talented on-ball defenders that they have. But he misses, and he shoots it a bit hard and a bit off the backboard, and all of a sudden the conversation is different. And so I see this maybe the most, possibly because I now host a show with Bills fans, who, like, let's not kid ourselves. This is the best you've had it as a Bills fan in most of their lives. If you are our age, the best since your childhood. You want to go back to the Rob Ryan years? You want to go back to the Doug Marrone years? You essentially make the playoffs almost every year since Josh Allen and Scott McDermott showed up on the scene. Josh Allen is by far and away the best QB in fantasy. Now, that doesn't help you on Sundays in the win column, but it shows you that he's a clearly productive player. I just feel like if you can't enjoy this team, which might, let's be frank, miss the playoffs, but if you can't enjoy this, what was the point of like all the struggle? The struggle was to get to this. You should at least enjoy the roller coaster that you're on right now. Not every team can be a dynasty. That's why they're called dynasties. Like, that's the whole point, is that they're rare increasingly. So That's my thesis statement. I don't know if I have a conclusion. I just feel like the level of expectation externally is too high. Because Haley made a very interesting and specific point to the level of expectation internally and how that manifests. And she sees the Toronto Maple Leafs being like playing on Team Canada, where gold is the expectation and that pressure is a privilege. And I get that. And I get why you don't want to play for, I was going to name another NHL team, but I don't really feel like having my mentions flooded. So why you don't want to play for another NHL market where the expectations aren't there, the level of fan interest and engagement isn't there. But if we're not enjoying any of this, then what's the point? Then just watch HBO on Sunday and not the NFL.
Well, you know, it's funny that you bring up what Haley said, because I thought that was, I've heard Haley Wickenheiser talk to the media like a million billion times, like over my entire life. She's one of my favorite interviews. So it was really cool that you got to chat with her just in a general sense. But it was really interesting, because I don't think I've ever actually heard her make that comparison before. And I know she hasn't worked for the Leafs like as long as she's played for Team Canada, but I thought that was fascinating comparison, just because you don't actually hear that all that often, even if I think a lot of people think it's true. And it was really funny, because I work on here at Sportsnet, one of the post-game shows as a producer, Leafs Talk with JD Bunkus and Sam McKee. And the show goes out on the radio and on YouTube. So whenever it airs on the Sportsnet's YouTube channel, Donovan, you can kind of see the comments come in. And I can't believe I'm saying this, but I love reading the comments after any Leafs talk, after any Leafs game that is on the Sportsnet page, because you get the widest breadth of opinions no matter what happens. Like they could lose a tightly contested game, and people say, oh, that was the best game the Leafs have played all year. Moral victory. Or they could win, but they wax a terrible team, and they say, ah, okay, well, it doesn't prove anything. The idea of expectations means so much to so many different people. And then you have some people who say, oh, well, as long as player X, Y, or Z is playing for this team, they're never going to win. They don't have what it takes. And you have a whole swath of other people who say, no, I completely disagree. These guys have what it takes. So I don't know. I find that comparison, especially because Haley kind of made it towards Team Canada, that has such a long, decorated history of the ultimate success, whereas the Leafs don't really. And again, you bring up the Bills. This is probably, in my lifetime, this is probably the best Leafs team I've seen. Like in a long time, right? I mean, I can't tell you. It might have been never, honestly, where I could feasibly, concretely, credibly say that one of the best five hockey players on planet Earth plays for the Toronto Maple Leafs. Like even when Matt Sundin was doing all those things, I don't know if he was like a top MVP candidate year in and year out that Austin Matthews is, or that William Nylander is playing at least so far this season. I only bring it up because, again, the idea of expectations have been skewed. And like you're mentioning, like, do you want to go, if you're a Bills fan, do you want to go back to the Doug Marrone years or like the Trent Edward years? No one wants that. And I don't really want to go back to the years where, you know, Leafs players would get like booed when they walked down the sidewalk because they weren't doing anything tangible. So I don't know. I find the comparison so interesting because Team Canada, especially on the women's side, has had just a ridiculous amount of success, and the Leafs, well, less so, right?
It was a real controversy whether or not the Leafs had to acknowledge the fans after a game. Like that was a real thing people talked about, right? So there's degrees to this, and it's a bit whack-a-mole in terms of this specific iteration of the team, what people are nitpicking, whether, oh, you're too offensive, your team is too offensive, you need some grit and some grinders too. Well, we don't have enough balanced scoring, and you got these lower lines that aren't pulling their weight in terms of scoring, or, you know, you need your more balance in terms of net minding. You're running your goalie out there too much, and he's getting tired by the end of the year, and you got to keep your goalie fresh. We don't have a number one goalie. We got these two goalies, but we don't have a true number one, someone that you can have steal a playoff game for. You like, there's always going to be an issue. You live in a salary cap world. Your team cannot be perfect unless you convince a bunch of people to play for said team for lower than market value, or you win when those players are incredibly young before they get expensive. See the Pittsburgh Penguins, see the Chicago Blackhawks. And after their star players got expensive, it became increasingly difficult to win. So I think that is the case there. I think the real thing for me, and it would be probably a gift and a curse, because I guess you want equity even in all of its forms, even if it's ugly. The real case for me is we are embarking on the beginning of a new day in women's professional hockey with the start of the PWHL. And I guarantee you, in one of the Canadian markets, and probably the one that we're both sitting in, Toronto, if said team, and I say said team because they don't have names, they're just the city. So literally said team with civic name does not meet whatever the expectations could be for a team that literally was made up, there is going to be fans who are outraged. Like, come on, Toronto. How did you not, whatever, win whatever the cup's going to be named, the Haley Wickenheiser Cup? How did you not finish first in the regular season? Like, this team is made up, number one. Number two, they have no history, so you should have no expectations. Three, it's just one season, a season that was thrown together at the last minute with players that were thrown together, essentially, at the last minute. But some fan base is going to be super egregious in this country that their PWHL team doesn't win, which is, I guess, it's great that you're keeping the same energy for the men that you are the women, but it just shows that sometimes in life, expectations are not based in reality.
Yeah, all I know is that as someone born and raised in the city of Toronto, I do already have expectations for Sarah Nurse to lead the Toronto team to some kind of championship, and that when she does, she will be a guest on Going Deep. That's the goal. I know Marie-Philippe Poulin plays for the Montreal team, you know, Kevin Clutch and all this. I get it. But if Toronto does not win, I'm already setting myself up for disappointment if they don't. But I don't know. I think they have a good chance. Look, before we get out of here, Donovan, I wanted to throw this by you just because, Haley, to go back, bring it back to what she was talking about with Team Canada. Have you seen this report that there will be some kind of best-on-best international competition for the men's team, which we have not gotten at the Olympics in essentially 10 years, but it's not quite a World Cup of hockey, which Sportsnet has done in the past, of course. The last one was in 2016, but it's like a four-team tournament in which Canada, the U.S., Sweden, and Finland will play. And I don't think it's been nailed down or anything, but I saw that report from, I think it was Frank Saravalli, who does a lot of stuff for Sportsnet as well. And I thought that was a fascinating tidbit to put out there, because people like Connor McDavid and Sidney Crosby and all these other guys have been clamoring for best on best. And obviously Crosby has played in best on best in international competitions a lot over his career. McDavid less so, because he's never played at the Olympics. And a lot of fans, especially fans of Canadian teams, want to see this. I kind of go back and forth on the idea of having a four-team tournament, but I'm curious what you think.
So as former guest on this podcast, Kate Fagan taught us, what makes people care? Stakes and storylines. I don't know if you have enough stakes or storylines for this made-up round robin that Russia is not a part of. You didn't qualify for it. We just essentially picked names out of that hat. Like, this is the BCS playoff system. We're literally going to make up the cup because this is new. It's not for an Olympic medal. It's not for really national pride, because we're not avenging a loss or extending a winning streak. I don't know that there will be the stakes and storylines to make people care. Will it be cool? Will it provide some content and some things to talk about and some arguments on who's going to be on the team? Because God knows, on trade deadline day, we got to throw up that board of, let's do it. Let's debate who are the three goalies from Canada. And, oh, what does this mean for goaltending when Sweden and United States have better goalies than us, and we've outsourced our goalies essentially just from the city of Montreal for so long, outside of Carey Price, obviously, who played in Montreal. Yeah, I don't think it's going to move the needle in the way that some people think, but that is a very good excuse to get Elliot Friedman on the bat phone to see, well, one, if he has any further information, but two, what he thinks. Because I think when Connor McDavid is talking in front of live mics and saying he craves from best on best, I think it's not even because of the competition of players in this era. I think it's for the competition with himself and players of previous eras. Sidney Crosby, who's obviously still part of this era. But Wayne Gretzky and Mario Lemieux. And when you look at their resumes at the end of the day, you'll say Stanley Cups, X. Hart Trophies, X. Olympic medals, X. And I don't know if this will fall into the realm that makes a dent on that resume the way a Canada Cup would have historically.
Yeah, I would agree. I think I just feel like I have fond memories of the 2010 Olympics with the golden goal and Canada snuffing the life out of every team at the 2014 Winter Olympics when they beat Sweden in the gold medal game. Like, I have very, very fond memories of those tournaments. And I feel bad that it's, I mean, 2014, essentially, we're at the end of 2023. It's almost 10 years ago that in the ensuing 10 years, people who are younger than I am, including my younger cousins who just like live and breathe hockey, never got to experience those same moments with Connor McDavid and perhaps Connor Bedard now that he's in the NHL, and other guys who are in between like Mitch Marner or Nathan MacKinnon or any of those guys. So I have very fond memories of watching Luongo play at the Olympics and Martin Brodeur play at the Olympics and yeah, like Jerome Iginla and so on. But you know, I want that for another generation of Canadian hockey fans. So I hope this four-team tournament, if not the answer, maybe is the spark that leads to something with the Olympics happening, because I don't know. I don't know if I really want to wait until, 2028 or 2030 or whatever it might be for the time the Olympics might actually see NHL players. But that's going to be a conversation we always have when it comes to the NHL players.
Well, I often wince when I see walking around Queen Street here in Toronto, or name a major street in a different Canadian city, and I see someone rocking that Team North America black,
you didn't like
gray,
it?
And
you didn't
orange
like the North America?
Under 23 B team. Like, this is not, you know, youth sports when we were kids where there's like every age group, you know, in a big city, there's an A and there's a B team because there's just so many applicants. So no, I didn't like that. I don't know what the legacy of that team will be. I mean, I was silently rooting for them to win just for them to make a mockery of the fact that they literally just made up a team to get some of these names that are now household names talked about. So yeah, I mean, it'll be fascinating. As you remember, those jerseys were made by Adidas. Because Reebok/Adidas had the NHL deal at the time, and it was an NHL tournament. As you know, Hockey Canada and most of the international hockey federations, United States, Russia, etc., are Nike branded. So for this four-team tournament, what uniforms will they be wearing, and who has jurisdiction on said things is where my mind immediately goes. Another question we can add to the docket for Elliot Friedman to source. We shall see. That's enough talking from us. Thanks for listening. Be sure to like, favorite, share, and subscribe. And if there is someone you want us to talk to, let us know. Cheers.